Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right. Please be seated. State versus Mitchell Green, 21 AP 267 CR. Appearances. All right, I have 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes in rebuttal, right? All right, please proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. I want to begin with the big picture in this case because I think there's a possibility that some of the details specific to this case are the larger legal principles at play here. So I do want to take a moment to address what I think the takeaway from this case should be. I don't think there can be any disputing that trial courts have the ability to issue and enforce orders regarding the introduction of evidence at trial. Yet the Court of Appeals' decision in this case seems to suggest that a criminal defendant can bypass one of those pretrial orders and require certain types of evidence to be vetted in advance, and instead force the court to hold that evidentiary hearing mid-trial before the court can determine whether a mistrial is appropriate.
Counsel, it isn't clear to me based on the record that the court actually entered those orders. I understand the argument that he was operating under the assumption that he had entered the orders, but is there an order in the record?
Sure. So this case, and that's one of the kind of the factual details that I mentioned that I think could steer the outcome in this case potentially, but shouldn't dictate the larger legal principle. I think if you look at Seafelt, and Seafelt is kind of a similar case in that it involved a pretrial order that was never recorded or placed on the record. And this court still acknowledged that that order was in effect, was enforced. So I think the court could make a similar determination here.
What kind of order, though? You're saying that there was an order that just wasn't on the record, but here there's just a motion in limine that is hard to read and maybe covers this and maybe doesn't. But in any event, there's no order. It wasn't ever made. This was never discussed, right?
Well, again, I don't know that we know that it was never discussed. I think when you look at the transcripts that are relevant around here, there were a lot of discussions that did take place off the record. And so it is completely possible that the discussion that involving the order took place off the record. And when you look at the way that Mr. Green's counsel addressed the issue when they were discussing whether or not to declare a mistrial, Mr. Green's counsel didn't seem to argue that there was no order in effect. He argued that this wasn't Denny evidence, but he didn't seem to challenge the fact that the court had issued an order or that there was a requirement. And by failing to sort of raise it at that point, both the court and the state didn't get the opportunity to actually make sure that if there was going to be some sort of issue with this, that got placed on the record very clearly for appellate.
So you want us to read into this record that there was some order that was in effect?
I think the court can look at the circuit court's interpretation of what its determinations were pre-trial and look at the arguments of both parties that were made at trial and conclude that there was, in fact, an order in effect, that all parties were acting as though there was.
So are you saying that the order in effect was in response to a discovery demand, or are you saying the order was in effect in response to the state's motion in limine?
It appears that the order was in response to the state's motion in limine and also
the
trial court's practice.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
So both the motion in limine and possibly the trial court's practice. The trial court mentions multiple times, I think in the hearing involving the motion to dismiss with prejudice, about its general practice, and it's not clear from the record whether the local rules or whatever the case may be there. And again, this is stuff where if Mr. Green's initial trial counsel had pushed back and said, Your Honor, there is no order precluding this evidence from being introduced at this point.
So that
factual issue could have been clarified.
There are 13
counsel
separate motions.
Oh, no, please.
Okay. Thank you, Justice Anne Bradley. I have just one quick question. I'm looking at the motions in limine. It was filed on August 22nd, 2019. There are 13 different motions here, right?
Yes.
So are you arguing that all 13 of these were then in effect, all 13 of these have been
advanced? I'd have to look back at the record on that. There was a particular pretrial hearing. I think there was discussion about a few of them. But this, again, I think is where a local rule could have come into play, and we don't have that in the record because there was no pushback. But, you know, there could conceivably be a local rule where essentially you have motions in limine are deemed granted unless they are objected to.
I'm just imagining someone, I mean, you're asking us to I'm just going to ask one more question, Justice Amos Bradley, sorry. If hypothetically, I were assigned to write this opinion, what am I supposed to write about this part? That I'm just supposed to assume that there was a motion in limine and assume there was a court? Like, I don't, how would you get there?
Again, I would start with the broad legal principles because the state's petition for review does raise, I think, the overarching issue about the admissibility of the evidence. And I do think that is the reason why the state requested the court take this case, and we are hoping for an answer there. I think then in terms of whether the motion in limine, you know, whether there was a violation of a pretrial order and whether there was a pretrial order in effect, I think the way the court gets there is, again, by looking at the way that the circuit court treated it and looking at the way that the parties treated it at trial. And there seems to be acknowledgement. There was no pushback. There was no argument raised at trial that there was no order forbidding the introduction of dead evidence. The argument that was made at trial was that this wasn't. And, you know, I think the circuit court had no trouble determining that it was. The state has consistently argued that this is Denny evidence, and therefore that is third-party perpetrator evidence. It should have been vetted in advance.
Okay, says who says?
I'm sorry?
Where do you get that it should have been vetted in advance? So I hear you that if there was some order, maybe the state would be, maybe that defense would have violated it. I hear you that if that was the case, maybe that's the answer there. We don't have proof of that. So what else was done wrong here? We're in Denny, and I've got Denny right here. I've read it. I've read cases after it where stuff has come up in the middle. You could, in theory, have a witness that you didn't know was going to say something. So where in Denny does it say it has to be vetted ahead of time and that it's a violation to not do that?
Denny doesn't specifically say that. Again, I think it comes from the court's order.
So if we don't have an order, do you lose?
I think that there is another path where the state could still prevail. I think obviously becomes a lot harder if this court determines that there was no order. But I think, again, when you look at the broader legal principles underpinning the prescription on double jeopardy and the deference afforded to circuit courts there, I think the court could say that the circuit court effectively acted reasonably in concluding that this sort of evidence should not have come in, again, separate from any order based on the lack of counsel for Mr. Cousin.
And I'm sorry, I've totally hijacked this. I'm going to let Justice Anne Walsh Bradley ask her questions because you were trying to...
In some ways, this is my lucky day. It's my lucky day because I have two really talented attorneys in front of me who I'm interested in hearing their argument. You started out saying big picture. In my mind, red flag. Red flag, why is he going for the big picture? He's going for the big picture because the minute facts aren't helpful here. And the minute facts include, as I see it, that there is no order on the record that we can rely on. And there's also, as noted in footnote 4 in the Court of Appeals, no state discovery demand appears in the record. You know, these are problems. You can't say, well, you know, that should have turned over the statements or should have turned over other stuff. Well, there's no demand in the record. And at the hearing, this prosecutor said he had no personal knowledge that there ever was a demand filed. It's typically filed, he's the prosecutor said. So isn't that really what's going on here? Without a demand for discovery, which wasn't arguably honored, but there was no demand, without a court order, there is no violation of a court order. And so you've got to focus on the big picture because the small picture is problematic for you. Respond.
Well,
see if my intuition is correct for such a talented lawyer.
I'm not going to try and hide the ball in the court, Your Honor. I think we've all heard the phrase that bad facts make bad law. And the state is concerned that some of the specific facts, you know, things weren't done perfectly here. I'll readily admit that. And I think if they had been, it's possible we wouldn't be here. But I do think that the Court of Appeals decision is a published opinion, or sorry, not as a published, but as an authored opinion, is citable. And it does raise an issue that I think does raise a lot of red flags for the state. And that is, in a situation where there is a pretrial order, or if it's something statutory, such as needing to give notice of an alibi witness, under the Court of Appeals reading of Seifelt and reading of the law, the circuit court, the trial court, would effectively hand control of the trial over to the defendant, because the defendant could elect to raise that issue at any point during trial, and if it gets the evidence in front of the jury, then the court has to hold an evidentiary hearing mid-trial in order to determine whether a mistrial is appropriate. And the sort of natural follow-up to that is, if the court determines that the evidence is admissible, that it would be admissible, how can the trial court ever enforce its pretrial orders? And so there's a few different ways to sort of look at the big picture here. And I think one is that the violation of the pretrial order here, assuming there was one, and I know that that's a topic of dispute. I recognize that, but the violation of the pretrial order here, I think, is different than Seifelt, because Seifelt involved other acts where you could have a quick determination, right? Is this admissible under, you know, for a purpose that we generally understand another act to be admissible? And in Seifelt, I think it was motive. So that's a very quick determination. I think it's reasonable to require the trial court to make that determination on the fly. A situation like this, and I think this is probably going to be a fairly rare situation. It's not your typical Denny case where you have somebody coming up and saying, oh, I heard so-and-so say that he did it. Right? You have somebody coming up and essentially trying to take the fall for his cousin. And so that fairly unique situation raises a number of issues, some of which are typical to a normal Denny defense, which would be the ability of the state to investigate, find witnesses, and that. But also then, the circuit court said very clearly, I would have made sure that Mr. Cousin had the advice of counsel before testifying. And I think the circuit court should know that this is going to happen so that it can require that before he testified. I think it's very telling in Mr. Green's brief before this court, his argument that the evidence now comes in anyways because we have the transcripts. And if Mr. Green elects not to testify after talking to a lawyer, well, he's now an unavailable witness. His testimony can come in, and the strategy that was used in the initial trial that resulted in the mistrial has effectively circumvented this protection for Mr. Cousin that the circuit court would have insisted on. And so I think that's where we get into a big problem with how the Court of Appeals viewed this case and viewed what the circuit court should have done here. The other way to look at it is not only sort of distinguishing Seifelt, but simply to interpret what the circuit court did here as a determination that this evidence was not admissible first trial. And I think the argument that the circuit court then determined that the evidence would be admissible for the second trial is a bit of a red herring, because in the second trial, Mr. Green followed the correct process. He gave notice of a Denny defense. They had a hearing. There was briefing. And so it did become admissible in the second trial. That doesn't mean that it would have been admissible in the first trial, because that process was not followed.
Oh, counsel, I just went through this record, and there's no mention on any date prior to this trial of any discussion of any of these motions in limine. I can't find them. I see two final pretrial records that have five pages where they've just put the offer on the record. I even went back to some motion that was raised that wasn't this. So where do you say that this pretrial order that the defense violated is, I mean, where would I find that?
Again, I think like Seifelt, in Seifelt, this court did acknowledge that the pretrial order was not placed on the record. It didn't.
Wasn't there something else in Seifelt to show that everyone understood that there was a order?
I think we have that here from the discussion that went on when they were discussing the mistrial. I think all the court, the state, and the defense all argued that issue based on an understanding that such an order was in place. So I think that's how the court gets to a conclusion that there was in fact an order.
You referenced local rules at one point. Obviously, we could take judicial notice of procedural type rules. Are there rules the court
I haven't looked into that because I think I didn't want to get too far down that road. Specifically, I think we are looking at larger legal principles here, but I think that's just sort of one example of how the argument that Mr. Green initially made in the trial court sort of colored what we ended up with as a record here.
When I've looked at a number of mistrial-type cases, particularly in the federal setting, you know, you have a mistrial request by defense sometimes because they feel as if the state has either goaded them into that or made multiple errors, and there are occasions when the defense specifically withdraws that, and then the court later sort of surprises everyone with a mistrial being granted. That's not the situation we have here. What we have here is really the defense presenting evidence that the state couldn't anticipate being presented, and a host of questions that go along with that evidence being presented in very serious charges, trafficking a child, physical abuse of a child, intentionally causing bodily harm, disorderly conduct. This is a big case. This isn't a run-of-the-mill, you know, disorderly conduct or something that might be considered less serious. This is a big case. The court referenced filing the motions in limine along with jury instructions and all those things. These motions in limine, to me, look a lot more like a discovery demand than a motion in limine. What should we make of that, and what should we make of the fact that the defense never objected to the mistrial? Never. Not one objection. The court's talking about it. They're setting other dates, and there isn't one single mention of, Judge, you're depriving me of this jury deciding my case. I need to make a record on that.
Well, I think so. So I think, you know, Mr. Green did object to the mistrial, I think, during trial, but the argument was based not in he did argue that there was no discovery violation.
He argued that he was not presenting Denny evidence.
Right.
He was answering the objection to evidence, an
right.
evidentiary objection. I don't think that's the same as an objection to a mistrial.
I'd have to take a closer read of that to see. When I read it, honestly, I sort of read it through the assumption that he had. But I think, again, when you look at that overall chunk of the record and kind of the afternoon hearing, I think is when everything really happens after everyone
right.
returns from lunch. I think the record sort of. You do have to read between the lines a little bit about some of the stuff because there's reference to multiple discussions that have taken place off the record. I think one happens before they actually come back on the record, and then they break again and go into chambers, and there's another discussion there. And I think there's probably a lot happening there. And the court is saying things that the trial attorney never argued against, things like, you know, if it had been the state doing this and dropping a surprise witness, we absolutely would have been all over the state. I would have dragged the DA up here to yell at him, basically, is what the court says. And so, you know, the argument that defense counsel makes at that point is not, there is no order. It's not, you know, it's that this isn't Denny evidence. And again, I think I think the circuit court had no problem determining that it was Denny evidence. I think the state has consistently argued that it's Denny evidence. I think
it's third-party perpetrator evidence.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's
someone else saying, I did this.
It's unusual, right? It's unusual because, you know, frequently we don't get people who come in and say, no, it wasn't him, it was me. Usually it's, you know, I heard somebody in jail say that they did it or whatever the case may be, but
you know, child trafficking cases have unique characteristics to them. As far as, I mean, just look at the facts that are alleged in the complaint here, the intimidation and the things that go on. I would think that both sides should be entitled to a fair trial, not just the defense, but also the state. And this was sprung on the state out of the blue, was it not?
It was. It was. And that raises, I guess, a couple of points that I wanted to come back to, both from Mr. Green's brief and from the Court of Appeals decision. One involves the fact that Mr. Cousin was listed as a witness on the witness list. And I think that really doesn't do anything.
I want to talk about Cousin for a minute, Mr. Cousin.
Did you have a chance to answer my question?
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your answer to the Chief Justice's question. I thought you were transitioning, but
I think it is sort of an answer to the question that the idea that Mr. Cousin was included on the witness list, I think, doesn't really hold a lot of weight, because the DA could have seen this and they could have asked the police to go talk to Mr. Cousin, and Mr. Cousin could have told them to take a hike. It is simply not the same as presenting alleging that a Denny defense, or, as I mentioned, I think a different situation could be like an alibi. It just simply including them on the witness list is not the same. So,
I'm sorry. Did you want to follow up at all, Chief?
No.
Okay. I was having a hard time understanding the circuit court's rationale with regard to Mr. Cousin. I want to give you an opportunity to defend that, if you'd like, on this. I'm trying to figure out why the fact that he didn't have an attorney, why that could serve as grounds for a mistrial. It's not a custodial interrogation or anything like that. I mean, if somebody wants to go up and, you know, admit that they did a crime, I'm trying to figure out how that, the whole point of this is kind of getting to the truth, right? I get it. There's things about it being sprung on you and being surprised. I understand there's debates about that. I'm trying to figure out how that gets to the point of a manifest necessity for a mistrial if somebody comes up and says, I did it.
Sure.
I don't understand. Just because he doesn't have an attorney when he's obviously implicating himself. I don't understand the logic of that, and so I'd appreciate any help with
that. So I think it's less about, because it, you know, Cousin may have refused the assistance of an attorney. He may have said, you know, I don't need an attorney, I know what I'm doing, whatever. He may have done all of that. I think the larger point is that the court would have at least made it available. And this comes back to the process that was used to get this evidence into the record, and into the record that Mr. Green now says he plans to use in a retrial.
Does the trial court have to make available, or is that just a nice thing, a good thing to do?
I'm sorry.
The court would have undergone a different process to make it. The court, you know, may have made an attorney available for him to make him aware of what he was doing. So maybe that's good practice. Is the trial court required to do that? How would that be grounds for a mistrial, though?
I don't know that the trial court is required to do that. I think you're right that it's not required. But again, it comes down to the reason that the circuit court would have had all of this in place, all of this pretrial procedure in place, would be to make sure that you know, consistent with the court's practice, or consistent with the court believes to be best practice, That something like this doesn't happen.
If you have somebody who goes and takes a stand and admits to committing a crime, under best practices, it would have been, you know, maybe he would have had an attorney available to him. I still don't see how that's grounds. I mean, we're only here reviewing the mistrial. I mean, that's the question before us. I still don't understand how that would be grounds to order a mistrial. Maybe the court would like things to operate in a more orderly fashion. Maybe the court thinks this would be good justice and good for everybody involved. But how would that be grounds for a manifest necessity to order a new trial?
Well, I think if you look at Arizona versus Washington, I think that is a case where the U.S. Supreme Court really talks about the deference to the trial court and why there's that deference to the trial court. And essentially, what the court said there is that there may be situations where the trial court is not comfortable with what has gone on, that it has concerns that the result of the trial might not be fair and just, I think is the language that it uses. And in those cases, the U.S. Supreme Court does not think that the Double Jeopardy Clause should sort of act as this damper on the circuit court sort of saying, not comfortable with what happened here, we need to try again. And so, especially in a situation where the state hasn't requested the mistrial, where it's a result of what the defendant has done, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that in those sorts of cases, we do give more deference to.
You know, I saw a decent number of these, you know, when I was in the Court of Appeals. I can't think of a single one where I thought that the trial court's discretion was erroneous to exercise with regard to granting or not granting a mistrial. I'm having a hard time just seeing what the legal hook is here to do it. And maybe the best argument that maybe is out there, and I want to give an opportunity to expand on it, is because we do defer, right? And the trial court's there, sees what's going on, reading the evidence, and gets to make some of those judgment calls about potential prejudice and those sorts of things. So I'm very sensitive to that. But I didn't see the trial court do much of that here. It seemed to basically assume it couldn't have dealt with the Denny evidence that came up, but it could have, and then seemed to rely on Cousin not having counsel. I don't see that going anywhere, just to be frank. And so I'm trying to understand what exactly did, if the defense counsel did violate order, maybe that's your strongest argument there, because then that's a different situation, and maybe that implicates that. If not, what is the other hook?
I see my red light has been on. Would it be all right if I
have a brief answer? Otherwise, the question took a while. We'll have you address it.
I think the answer might be a bit longer, so I'll talk about that in rebuttal, if that's
okay,
all right.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Attorney Patrick Earle represented Mitchell Green at this aborted trial, and I'd like to start by asking the court to consider from his perspective how things occurred here. As he was preparing for trial, he received no discovery demand, and nonetheless, 5 months before the trial date, he filed a witness list naming Jonathan Cousin as a defense witness. He filed a later amended witness list that also listed Jonathan Cousin. And he didn't provide the written account of Jonathan Cousin's statement that he had as part of his trial preparation. And the state is now asserting he should have provided it.
Well, didn't he have a statutory obligation to provide it?
I can't see where that statutory obligation would come in the absence of a discovery demand, because the wording of the discovery statute says.
And you wouldn't think that subsection 9 of the motions in limine, which was concerned about third-party perpetrator evidence and wanting notice of that, would have anything to do with discovery? I mean, that's what the whole thing is about. Tell us before you do it whether you're going to have third-party perpetrator evidence. I mean, that's what it says. Well, I mean, just because it's in a document that's got a ton of other stuff, it doesn't mean they're not asking for it. That's what they're doing.
Well, they did ask for Scheidel evidence, third-party perpetrator evidence of an unknown suspect.
I understand the difference between Scheidel and Denny. So does everybody on the bench, okay? The difference has no distinction when you're describing third-party perpetrator, which is what we're talking about with Mr. Cousins, right? That's what we're talking about. He said, I did it, not Green. I mean, that's what he testified to, correct?
From Mr. Earle's perspective, that was not correct, because Mr. Cousins wasn't admitting to committing any crime. He said I was the unwitting driver in that car. He did not admit to criminal intent, and Mr.
That's
Earl...
That's a question for another court, not for this court. Okay?
Okay, but I started out asking the court to consider it from Mr. Earl's perspective, and that was his stated perspective on the record, that this isn't third-party perpetrator evidence. This is just an innocent person assuming the role of driver.
Does the circuit court have any obligation to be sure that someone who's testifying in the circuit court's court is not being intimidated into taking the stand and essentially testifying, at least from my view, if not that he was the perpetrator, certainly very close to it? Doesn't the circuit court have any responsibility to be sure that the testimony in the court is not intimidated testimony? I mean, what benefit does Mr. Cousins have with giving this testimony at the last minute, without ever giving it before, apparently, except in a written statement that defense had that defense didn't turn over to the state?
I don't understand the basis for assuming that there was some intimidation involved here. Mr. Cousin was a cousin of Mitchell Green.
That you're absolutely correct on all of that. My concern is did the circuit court have any concern to be sure there wasn't intimidation here? That's what I took from the circuit court saying, has he consulted an attorney? I think he should consult an attorney before he does this. I mean, you know, the person was of age, and you say, well, he can make his own decision. But I think the circuit court, at least to me, I read it as being concerned that there might have been some intimidation on Cousins to get up there and testify as he did.
Well,
otherwise, why would he need a lawyer?
The court's concern was reflected by the request that a lawyer come.
Right.
And if Mr. Cousin was going to return to the witness stand and the trial were to continue, that would happen only after consultation with a lawyer.
Well, his testimony is going to be used in the second trial. It doesn't matter if he has a lawyer now or not. It's too late.
Right.
Because they can read his sworn testimony in the record as though he were sitting there looking at the jury.
On the other hand, the entire direct examination of Mr. Cousin went without any interruption by the court, without any interruption with an objection by the state, and then the state, after they knew exactly what he was saying, didn't object, didn't ask for a sidebar.
Well, they did it after a break. I think the state was very taken aback by it. I mean, when you get something in court, are you sure you've tried cases? I've tried a ton of cases before I became a judge. You get surprises in almost every trial. You get surprises. Some are you can deal with. It's not a big deal. Some you're kind of left flat-footed because it was nowhere near what you were thinking you were going to do. So that there wasn't an immediate objection, I don't put any weight on at all, to be honest with you. They did certainly object after the, was it lunch break, or there was some kind of a break that they took, and then they...
It was a lunch break, a noon recess.
Counsel, is there anywhere in this record that is either a discovery demand or some kind of order reflecting that Denny needed to be provided, or even any kind of order on these motions in limine?
No.
And is the 9, which is the request I think at issue here on this motion in limine, is a request to prohibit the defense from introducing other acts evidence, including a third-party perpetrator? If that's not ruled on, do you as a defense attorney, along with all these others, do you see those as being in effect if you never get an order from a court on this motion?
My understanding would be it becomes binding when the court says so ordered after hearing from the parties whether there's any objection.
But why
that never happened
that,
here.
But, counsel, why didn't you say that, or why didn't counsel say that when that was raised below? Your opposing counsel makes that point, that everybody seemed to assume that these orders were in effect.
Right.
Well, in my brief, when I first asked for reconsideration of the motion to dismiss, I pointed out there was no basis for Mr. Earl to have turned over the statement that of Mr. Cousins, the written account. And it was there that I brought up motion in limine number 9 to point out that it didn't apply. And even then, the prosecutor, Ms. Court, never responded and said, oh, yes, this did apply. This is why it should have been turned over. That first arose in proceedings in the Court of Appeals
But the argument below was that it wasn't, wasn't Denny evidence, and so the order by its terms, if it's there, wouldn't have applied, which is different than saying there was no order in effect at all. Was this an order or not? It's, if it was, does it apply or not? Those are two separate questions.
Right. Well, I would say that were the motion in limine turned into an order, Denny's not included within it, but it never became an order. It never became the motion in limine, which is a request for an order, never became an order in limine.
Why didn't they argue that then? Why didn't the defense say there is no order that requires this judge, instead of arguing this isn't Denny evidence? It sure does look like the defense thought they had to turn something over, because they were arguing it's not included within that which we have to turn over.
Right.
Why wouldn't they just say, Judge, there's no obligation to turn this over, whether it's Denny evidence or not? I don't understand the argument. Is there a local rule that was in place?
In part, unlike in Seyfeld, there was a question about the order because the terms of it weren't part of the record. But when the objection was made by the prosecutor to the opening statement in Seyfeld, the prosecutor's basis for objecting was there was a pretrial order, and the judge ruled there was a pretrial order. Here, no one said to Mr. Earle, you violated this order, and gave him a chance to respond to it.
Right.
There was no order. I mean, turn that around. Why didn't the prosecutor say Mr. Earle violated some pretrial order? And the answer is because there was none.
Everybody argued as if this was an order in place. Everyone argued this as if the question was, is this something we were obligated to turn over? It's just interesting. Is there a local rule? That part I didn't hear you answer.
A local rule?
That deals with motions in limine or discovery in Milwaukee. Milwaukee's its own place, so there are local rules in every community. But if there's a local rule that addresses this, that might explain this too.
Well, the one local rule I remember, and I believe I cited it in my brief to the Court of Appeals, was a local rule that requires there be a pretrial order, and there was no pretrial order here. Okay. So that was simply ignored.
Just to talk briefly about this witness, I have to tell you, I think this is a good practice to know whether or not someone is going to incriminate themselves before they actually get on the stand under oath and do so. And so, for example, when I might have hearings as a trial judge and someone would come in and it looked as if they were about to incriminate themselves, I'd stop and advise them of the right to counsel, the right against self-incrimination. I would give them all sorts of indications that they have constitutional rights that are at play, especially when they're taking the stand under oath and confessing, essentially, to a crime. So that's a good practical reason why judges, and I think probably most judges in the state, do try to preempt some things like this so that people are aware of their rights before they confess on the stand. Isn't that a good practice, and isn't that a good reason for the judge to have at least considered that? I did that.
Well, I
think most judges would have done that.
Things might have been different had either the prosecutor objected or the judge on his own interrupted once the nature of Mr. Cousins' testimony became clear. That simply never happened. This was all allowed to play out.
So what was the cadence of this? When did Cousins testify? When did they take a lunch break? What did they do right after lunch? How did this work?
Mr. Cousins was called late in the morning. Judge Borowski described 25 minutes of pretty compelling testimony, so I assume it was around 11:30. He completed his direct examination by Mr. Earle without any objection. The prosecutor then proceeded to cross-examination. Mr. Earle was discussing some document he planned to present in redirect, and the court said, well, it's lunchtime, let's take a recess. Then the next transcript is that afternoon when the parties are on the record without the jury being present, and they mention we've been discussing this matter for about 5 minutes and there are some concerns, and they went on to discuss it at length.
So in other words, there was the testimony, there was a lunch break, people thought about this, they came back and discussed it right after lunch.
Right, and Ms. Court, the prosecutor, brought her superior, Ms. Carson, along with her, and they, interestingly enough, there was some discussion with Mr. Blimling about whether there was an objection to a mistrial motion, but there was no mistrial motion. The court Ms. Carson objected to this testimony and asked the court to consider remedies, including striking the testimony or giving a curative instruction or whatever the court thinks is best, but the prosecutor never moved for a mistrial or used the word mistrial. The court chose that relief to the state on its own, and therefore Mr. Earle never really had a chance to say, I object to a mistrial, because no one moved for it.
How long was the hearing? I thought it was about 30 pages after lunch when they talked about the evidence, the problem with the evidence, the potential for a mistrial, scheduling a status date, and then ultimately the court said, I'm going to grant the mistrial. Courts grant mistrials on their own motion. It's often with others, but a court can make its own motion, right? I mean, that's not a problem. It's just the issue we're dealing with.
Well, I think whether the court granted the motion at the state's request or on its own doesn't really alter the manifest necessity question.
Right.
I think that's the same question regardless of who first said the word mistrial, the court or the moving party.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that wasn't...
Go ahead.
Thank you. What's the difference between prostitution and human trafficking?
Could you say it again?
What is the difference between prostitution and human trafficking?
Thank you.
Prostitution can be a component of human trafficking, and if you transport a person...
No. Throughout your brief, you conflate those two, and I think when you do that, you show tremendous disrespect to the victim in this case. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Human trafficking, you need force, fraud, and coercion. Can a child who is the victim of human trafficking consent?
Of course not.
Right. Can a child who is a victim of human trafficking then be an underage sex worker? Can a victim of human trafficking go on a prostitution date, which, by the way, is a term the state uses too, which blew me away? Can any of that happen?
Not with consent. You're absolutely correct.
Right. I got to tell you, so our Constitution provides for protection for victims. Do you agree with that?
I do.
Okay. In Article 1, Section 9M, 2A of our Constitution says that victims have the right to be treated with dignity, respect, courtesy, sensitivity, and fairness. And when you put in your brief on page number 11, during the ride back to drop them off, I think you meant to put in Appleton, Mr. Cousin heard SAB tell JR about a guy asking her if he can spit in her mouth, which she allowed. I looked through this record so closely to see whether or not this 17-year-old human trafficking victim, who after this offense went back and the human trafficker took her phone, changed the password, pulled a gun out, so that she had every understanding in the world that she had zero freedoms whatsoever. And you put in your brief that she allowed him to spit in her mouth. I have to tell you, when I read that, I had to put your brief down and used all the self-discipline I have, and I have a lot, to pick the brief back up. It was so offensive to me. And I just want you to imagine that somewhere in a conference room, somewhere in this state, that young victim was sitting with a victim witness professional going through what you said about her. And I am positive she did not feel like she had been treated with dignity, respect, courtesy, sensitivity, or fairness. You talked about her agreeing to be spit in her mouth. You called her a underage sex worker. You talk about her engaging in prostitution. And I just have to say that as far as advocacy is concerned, it makes, and I have made these points before, and I'm going to make these points again up here. It is the job, it is part of our job of the judiciary to make sure that all victims are treated with dignity, respect, courtesy, sensitivity, and fairness, and I did not see that in your brief. And it didn't matter, right? Because there's no question here that she was a victim of human trafficking.
I apologize that I didn't give proper consideration to the matters you mentioned, Your Honor. And obviously she was subjected to things rather than simply doing things. She was forced to do them.
Counsel, I wanted to follow up with a question on the admissibility of the on the question of what the trial court what you think the trial court was supposed to do when this evidence came in. Is it your position that the trial court had to make a decision on admissibility or has to make a decision on admissibility all the time? Obviously, we have this later finding this evidence, you know, would have been potentially, you know, would have been admissible as Denny evidence. Is it your position that a trial court, that this trial court needed to do that, that they always need to do that, or no?
I believe that when the court's considering a mistrial based on evidence that the jury heard, the real question becomes one of jury taint. That was the focus and the basis for the decision in the Arizona versus Washington case. The jury was irreparably tainted because the defense introduced in opening statement matters that were highly prejudicial to the state and that would never be admissible evidence. That's why that mistrial declared in Arizona versus Washington was done with manifest necessity. Here, the jury heard, call it Denny evidence, call it third-party perpetrator evidence, but they heard Mr. Cousins' testimony, and I think the court's initial obligation is to determine, was this admissible? And they have to do it for a number of reasons. One, if you're going to consider a less drastic remedy than a mistrial, such as a curative instruction, yeah, you have to determine, well, what's the error here? What needs to be cured? There was no error, is my position.
Let me just follow up with just a little wrinkle. I understand why that may be advisable in most situations, but what if the trial court determined that even if this were admissible, it was prejudicial to the state? Would that be acceptable? Do you think there would always need to be a determination of admissibility in order to rule on it? Just even assume, even if it was admissible, I'm not ruling on one way or another, but the way this came in was overly prejudicial to you know, one party. Do you think that would be sufficient, potentially? I know it's in your view, it may be a different situation than we have here. Maybe the state would disagree, but I'm trying to think about situations where there doesn't always need to be the trial court's hands are tied to conduct a Denny hearing mid-trial when this stuff shows up. Could the trial court determine, you know, in its discretion that there was a taint because of the way this came in? Even if it could have come in, it would have, you know, the way it came in was prejudicial.
Well, often when I object, when I'm acting on behalf of a defendant and say objection prejudicial, the court responds almost every bit of evidence introduced by a prosecutor is prejudicial to the defense. That's why they're introducing it. And here, obviously, Mr. Cousins' testimony was prejudicial to the state's case because it presented an alternative account of what happened, and under that alternative account, Mitchell Green wasn't there and wasn't guilty. If that's the basis for finding prejudice, then you're saying, well, there's a horrible problem here in that Mr. Green was being effectively represented. Now, if you think the prejudice arose from the fact that it was a surprise to the prosecutor, then I would object to that notion because for 5 months after having Jonathan Cousins' name on a witness list, the prosecutor exhibited zero curiosity in what this person, presumably completely unknown to Ms. Court, would have to say. When I get a prosecution witness list as a trial attorney I look through it, and if there's some name on there I don't recognize, I'm on the phone or shooting an email to the prosecutor saying, who is this person and what are they going to say? And Ms. Court never did that.
So
and then she found herself in a situation, surprise, now I know what Mr. Cousin has to say, and I'm caught, you know, without any recourse here because I didn't prepare.
Attorney Wazlewski, so I hear what you're saying, and I do think you are correct that all evidence is prejudicial to either side, otherwise it wouldn't go in, right? But what about some kind of view from us as to it being overly prejudicial, right? And that's where some of those factors that maybe you've talked about would come into play. The fact that they had a witness list, the fact that they could have objected, the fact that that at the end of the day this evidence wound up being deemed to be admissible. If we were to have some kind of lens of that in terms of manifest necessity in this kind of circumstance, would that make sense? Do you see what I mean? I mean, I think the fear is that we're going to tie hands. The fear is that we're going to make it so Denny can be sprung on people, even though Denny doesn't say anything about when you have to bring those types of motions. But when we talk about manifest necessity in this type of situation, would it make sense to require a circuit court to really look at the prejudice to the state and whether or not it's overly prejudicial such that it's a manifest necessity?
I'm still struggling with how it's prejudicial, overly or otherwise.
Well, they're saying that they didn't have a chance to investigate, right? That's all they could have done differently, perhaps, if they would have even done that. I don't know because there's no record about that. But maybe they would have had to make a record. What if it was a really, like this witness, I don't know how strong this testimony is, but what if there was someone who it really was a strong witness all of a sudden for the defense that the state had never seen before, never heard before? I mean, they do have a right to not have that sprung on them to some extent, right, to be able to investigate.
Well, then that comes when you file a discovery demand, a very basic thing that is done routinely with typically a boilerplate request for the things listed in the discovery statute, and that simply never happened here. And that puts, as I think I started out with discussing this from Mr. Earle's perspective, it puts him in somewhat of a dilemma. I often sit down with clients preparing for a trial, and we have a good witness, and that witness has given a statement, and I tell my client, well, now I have to put this witness's name on a witness list and give it to the state because they filed a discovery demand and asked for that, and I have to give a copy of my investigator's report of the interview with that witness because that's requested. Here, Mr. Earle didn't have any of that, and so what the state's basically saying is despite the fact that there was no obligation on his part under the discovery statute, and the state never really argues that there is, and there's no pretrial motion saying you must turn over Denny evidence or third-party perpetrator evidence of this type.
Didn't the defense file a witness list?
Yes, they did.
The defense filed a witness list.
Why would they do that if there's no discovery? You just said you'd do that pursuant to a discovery order.
And
they had no obligation to do that.
And I pointed out in my brief, despite the lack of obligation, he did turn that over. And as I was explaining, my clients often have trouble saying, well, why would you turn over our defense witness name and statement ahead of time? And I have to explain. Discovery demand triggers an obligation. Mr. Earle had no such obligation. And arguably, if he had turned it over in advance without any legal obligation to do so, he'd be betraying his client and undercutting his own defense.
So that's, I think the defense based on surprise is something that the attorney would be chided for.
So maybe it is an effective assistance,
right,
for him to turn over a witness list. He never had any obligation to turn over. Everything should have been by surprise, apparently.
Once you're on the witness list, then you have an obligation under 971-23-2M-AM to give written statements. But though defense counsel did name the witness and Mr. Cousins was on the witness list along with other people, he never turned over the written statement by Mr. Cousins, which would have let everybody know that that was third-party perpetrator evidence that he was planning to present.
Certainly, that's true. But
Is it unusual for you to, you know, be in the middle of a trial and there be no orders at all? And you just, I mean, nobody raised a flag and said maybe we ought to work through some of these things before trial?
Well, I found it unusual that there was never any discussion of the motions in limine that, typically you want to go through those one at a time and the court will either grant or deny those, and then those serve their purpose as relieving the party moving in limine from having to object during trial.
You were the attorney below, is that right?
I was the attorney below, appointed after Mr. Earle withdrew, which was after this mistrial.
Okay, you're right. You were the second attorney, yeah, okay.
It's a busy court, though, right, Mr. Wasilewski? I sat on this particular docket for 2 years. I think I probably averaged about 30 trials each of those years. There's a lot going on, and it's possible that something like this got missed, right?
Right, and there's another aspect that doesn't aid anybody in keeping continuity, which is that this was originally assigned to Judge Protasevich, and Judge Borowski took it on the morning of trial as a spin. So that type of thing can lead to Judge Borowski has the disadvantage not knowing about whether there were or weren't pretrial orders, but Judge Protasevich in earlier proceedings simply mentioned, oh, I see there's some witness lists and some motions in limine filed, and moved on to other things without ever addressing them at all in one of the 4 or 5 page transcripts to which I believe you made reference earlier.
So just of your argument, counsel, is you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't violate any orders, and therefore there was no, you know, in part, no need to order a mistrial, no manifest necessity. Or that the trial counsel didn't.
Well, I think the state mentioned the big picture here, and I think the big picture here is, did the state prove manifest necessity for a mistrial? That is the key issue here, and I think the reason they didn't is because this Denny evidence, even though it caught the prosecutor by surprise, was perfectly admissible evidence, and the jury heard it, and Mr. Earle said, the jury heard it, let the jury decide, but the court granted a mistrial anyways.
Isn't the bigger picture that in a child sex trafficking case, because Judge Protasevich didn't make rulings on motions before her, and the case got spun to Judge Borowski because Milwaukee is extremely busy, that, as the state put it, an accused child sex trafficker receives a windfall of walking free without even a trial?
Right.
Well, every time someone asserts successfully the double jeopardy, they arguably receive a windfall. But here, the alternative was simply to let the case continue to the jury. The state could have asked for a brief adjournment to investigate or to stop proceedings. That was the one alternative to mistrial they never suggested. Instead, they simply suggested a curative instruction. I see my time is up.
I had an answer. You're in the middle of an answer.
But the real key here is that a retrial is simply going to put that same evidence in front of the jury, but the state will have a chance to correct their lack of preparation and be prepared to meet Jonathan Cousins' testimony if they can find something to impeach him, as Judge Borowski noted in his decision denying mistrial. Now the state has the time to send out their investigator, send out more detectives, figure out a way to blow up or eviscerate or cross-examine Mr. Cousin. That's exactly why there is a double jeopardy clause, so that the state doesn't get a second kick at the cat because their first effort wasn't going very well. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Blimling, I think you should start up with answering Justice Hagedorn's question.
And I plan to. Thank you, Chief Justice. Justice Hagedorn, you ask, what is the legal hook here, essentially? What is the basis for finding a manifest necessity? And I think it's twofold. I think the argument that you just heard sort of suggests that this is just based on jury taint, and I don't think that's entirely correct. I do think there is a question of jury taint. I think that's one aspect here. And that comes from Mr. Green's failure to follow the correct process for vetting this evidence in advance, gets evidence put in front of the jury that it would not have otherwise had. Now, I mentioned during my first presentation that I think the fact that the court found that evidence to be admissible for the second trial is largely irrelevant because in preparing for the second trial, the evidence was properly vetted and noticed in advance. I think the other aspect here comes to returns to the question of counsel for Mr. Cousin, and I sent maybe some skepticism on your end that alone could be a basis, but I think it also speaks to sort of a larger issue here, which is sort of the circuit court having control of its courtroom and being able to drive how the trial will happen. And so I think when you get into a situation where a defendant has effectively taken over how evidence will be vetted in advance or presented in advance, then I think that is enough for the court to stop things and say, this is not how this should have happened. And so to declare a mistrial.
If the state wants a motion in limine ruled on, if the state wants discovery, isn't it the obligation of the state to follow up with that?
Yes.
So what I go back to with this whole idea, because it seems very important to all of this, is this idea of some order. Whose responsibility is that? Isn't that the state's responsibility? And if we don't have proof of it, are we supposed to then say, oh, well, we're going to hold that against the defendant as if it was there? I mean, who gets the benefit of that if we're unclear? Should it be the defendant or should it be the state who has total control over having a motion ruled on, asking for a ruling?
Well, that raises kind of a larger point that I wanted to respond with, Justice Dowd, and that is this idea of recourse and that this is maybe a recourse to the state. And I think that's largely inaccurate. I think when you look at this was a sua sponte order by the circuit court without a request from the state. It's clear that the circuit court can do that. It can declare a mistrial on its own motion. And so questions about whether the state is getting the proper recourse here, I think they largely miss the point because it's not about, the court did mention the ability of the state to now investigate and things like that. But again, you also have this added component of Mr. Cousin not having counsel and of the entire process kind of breaking down there. So
the state filed this motion when? It looks like August 22nd, 2019.
The motion in limine?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, the charges were filed, looks like the information's filed March 12th, 2019.
Right. Yep.
So several months later, the motion in limine is filed and then never ruled on before the jury trial in January of 2020?
So it was mentioned, and I apologize, I don't have the specific date at the hearing. I think it was briefly mentioned at one hearing that we have motions in limine, and there were
right.
No...
That was Judge Borowski, though. I'm talking about the judge whose case it was, Judge Protasevich. She never ruled on it? Do we know that for a fact?
I did not find anything in the record. I did look, because I sensed that this would be an issue. And again, I think the best answer I have there is that if you look at how all of the parties treated the argument of after lunch about whether this was a violation of a pretrial order or whether it was not Denny evidence, all of the argument seemed to follow this line of arguing that whether it was or was not Denny evidence, rather than whether notice was required to be given of a third-party perpetrator defense in advance.
All right. It's busy, and these things get spun off, and I just didn't know if there might be something somewhere else we were missing.
Unfortunately, not that I found in the
counsel,
record.
Counsel, so. Your first response on a sort of legal hook was failure to basically follow the correct process. And I'm getting hung up on the word correct. So does your correctness argument hinge on there being an applicable order, or is there some other part that makes it incorrect?
Chief Justice, I see my red light is on. If I could briefly
address
the question, I think it does largely rest on the pretrial procedures. Again, as I mentioned, I didn't attempt to add any local rules to the record here. It is conceivable in the larger picture in determining kind of when this court writes the opinion and instructs lower courts on how they should proceed in situations like this, that those specific facts, quirks of local procedure, should be, should not dictate kind of what the overarching principle is here. So, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Thank you for an interesting oral argument. We're adjourned. We'll reconvene.